From WBUR Boston, I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman appointed to the Supreme Court, announced today that she is retiring at age 75. Appointed by Ronald Reagan in 1981, unanimously confirmed by the Senate, O'Connor has been a crucial swing vote in many key court decisions. In 1992, she helped forge the majority that reaffirmed Roe v. Wade. In 2000, she was the fifth vote that ended the Florida ballot recount and made George W. Bush president. Her retirement gives the president his first opportunity to nominate a justice to the Supreme Court. And it comes at a time when Republicans and Democrats are deeply divided over the American judiciary. Tonight, On Point, the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor and the future of the Supreme Court. We begin tonight with reaction in Washington. This morning, President Bush spoke about the historic significance of O'Connor's appointment to the nation's highest court.
When President Ronald Reagan appointed Justice O'Connor 24 years ago, Americans had high expectations of her. And she has surpassed those expectations in the performance of her duties. This great lady, born in El Paso, Texas, rose above the obstacles of an earlier time and became one of the most admired Americans of our time. She leaves an outstanding record of service to the United States, and our nation is deeply grateful.
President Bush speaking this morning. Joining me now from Washington is Warren Ritchie. He covers the Supreme Court for the Christian Science Monitor. Warren, thank you for joining us.
Oh, good to be with you.
Can you give us the reaction to this decision there? The week began with talk, practically, hardening down into supposition that was going to happen, that Chief Justice Rehnquist would retire, and it ends with Sandra Day O'Connor's announcement. What was the reaction there?
Well, there was some surprise, but the fact is the White House 2 weeks ago actually floated the name of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and out with that came this suggestion that it might be O'Connor rather than Rehnquist stepping down. And so there have been some hints. You know, Washington has existed in a state of this flurry of speculation for the past 2 to 3 weeks in anticipation of the end of the term. And so I can't say that it was shock, but I think it's fair to say that there were a lot of surprised people, many, many surprised people this morning.
What were the reasons? Did she give her reasons? Are people around there hazarding what they might be?
She didn't give any reasons, and if there are people who really know the reasons, they're not talking. But from what we know about her life, we know her husband isn't well, and so that may be the factor. She had sold her house and gotten a smaller place in Washington, D.C. So that didn't necessarily mean she was leaving town, but now, in retrospect, it looks like, she was getting things in order. And perhaps it's a question of that she wants to spend time with her husband.
Well, of course, right on the election, the night of the election, her husband was quoted as saying, that's the 2000 election, her husband was quoted as saying, oh, when it looked as if Gore was going to win, oh my gosh, now we can't go back to Arizona. We were counting on Bush to win so that we could go back to Arizona. So in a way, she's getting the wish that she had in 2000. But wasn't there also another wish that she could become the first woman Chief Justice?
Well, who knows? You can speculate about that, and there were some suggestions that might happen, but I actually think it's interesting that you mentioned Bush v. Gore and the election in 2000. We might have had a retirement earlier because she had been talking about retiring before this, and it might have come earlier except for Bush v. Gore. Some of the justices who were in the majority in that case, I think, felt it would be improper, or perhaps it was a little too soon to leave, that they wanted a little bit of distance between that decision, which continues to be controversial, and their actual leaving the court, so that wouldn't be the very last chapter in this stage of history.
isn't that something? So it had just the opposite effect. She was hoping that, a Bush victory would allow her to go sooner. In fact, really, to almost put a decent interval between his coming and her going, she made it later.
It looks like that may have been a factor in why we didn't see anything earlier on.
Right.
Although it's very difficult, you know, this is all reading tea leaves because
sure.
These justices have, you know, for lawyers, this is the best job in the world. And, you know, although Justice O'Connor has said that she doesn't particularly enjoy this job, she sees it as a challenge and service to the country. But this really is, being a justice on the Supreme Court, it's great work. She is, you know, she's been termed the most powerful woman in the country. And, you know, that's no small task.
Indeed. Just briefly, what about William Rehnquist? What are we hearing there? The Chief Justice diagnosed with thyroid cancer, not looking all that hale, to say the least of it, when he went to the court on Monday, and yet no announcement. Is it anticipated? Have you heard anything on that front, on his possible retirement?
Well, you know, in the weeks running up to this, there were all these conflicting reports, and, you know, you could talk to 10 different people and get 10 different opinions. But one thing that did come out is the suggestion that perhaps the Chief Justice might wait until September and get a better sense of how his health is going and his treatment for thyroid cancer is going. And so it may be that by September, there's a pretty good idea of how far along the any replacement for Justice O'Connor, and perhaps there may even be a replacement. And if that was the case, then I think you're going to see a great deal of speculation about Chief Justice Rehnquist. And so we might get two new members of the court. Now, of course, if he were to announce in September, it would take a, you know, even at the fastest rate, it would take several months to get a replacement on the court.
Warren, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Great being with you.
Warren Ritchie covers the Supreme Court for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about today's surprise announcement that Sandra Day O'Connor is retiring after 24 years on the Supreme Court. Joining me now from Washington is Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at George Washington University and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Now, several years ago, you wrote a sort of canonical piece about Justice O'Connor in the New York Times Magazine called The Majority of One, and your first sentence was startling in its claim, quote, "We are all living now in Sandra Day O'Connor's America." What do you mean by that?
I guess I meant that it was hard to think of an issue of American life that wasn't ultimately decided by Justice O'Connor. The most hot-button issues in the culture wars, affirmative action, abortion, campaign finance, race-conscious voting districts, the presidential election, school prayer, gay rights, all these were issues where the court was closely divided, and Justice O'Connor cast the tie-breaking vote on one side or the other. But by Justice O'Connor's America, I didn't merely mean that she was the swing justice, because there are other justices who are in the majority nearly as frequently as she, Justice Kennedy as an example. Rather, there's something about Justice O'Connor's jurisprudence that reserves to the court in general, and Justice O'Connor in particular, the ability to have the final word on these issues. So by splitting the difference between left and right, by managing to channel the views of the median American voter with exquisite precision, Justice O'Connor really made herself into an avatar of American hopes and fears, and in some ways represented the views of the majority of the country even more effectively than the Congress did.
And yet she did this without invoking, well, with rare exceptions, any sweeping new principles. You write, each of her decisions is a ticket for one train only.
It's true. She was called by some a minimalist, a judicial minimalist, by which these scholars meant that she decided one case at a time and would never articulate broad constitutional theories. She would merely resolve the dispute in front of her without tipping her hand about her views about future cases. I'm actually not persuaded by the use of the term minimalist to describe Justice O'Connor, because so much of her jurisprudence really expanded the court's power in such a dramatic way. She certainly kept her options open, and people didn't know whether a particular affirmative action program was constitutional or a particular voting district was permissible until they asked Justice O'Connor's opinion. But she resolved these questions not by invoking the text or original understanding of the Constitution or other broad legalistic principles, but rather in a pretty pragmatic way. She had been a former politician, she was an Arizona state legislator, and as a justice she functioned much as the former legislator that she had been, making compromises between right and left and reaching decisions that were practical and made political sense, even though they didn't always make legal sense to constitutional purists.
And, of course, to some of those purists, because of their activism, because of her willingness to strike down laws, both of states and the federal government, former Judge Bork has spoken of judicial oligarchs. Was she a judicial oligarch?
Well, I don't think so. You have to be more descriptive, perhaps, than Judge Bork has been in describing what you mean by activism or oligarchy. I like a neutral definition of activism, which merely says that a judge is activist when he or she votes to strike down a law. If you vote to strike down a federal or state law, you're engaging in judicial activism. If you don't, you're not. That's not to say whether the activism is good or not, but it does describe whether or not the judge tends to like a broad use of judicial power. Now, as it happens, judged by this neutral criterion, Justice O'Connor is, in fact, among the most activist judges on the court. I think she's surpassed only by Justice Kennedy. He's voted to strike down the most laws. She's the second most activist. Nevertheless, I wouldn't call her an oligarch because she did have a sense of limitations on judicial power. After all, she often voted to uphold judicial precedents with which she disagreed, and that is not a sign of someone who's radically eager to overturn an awful lot of law.
Jeffrey Rosen, we'll come right back to you. We're talking about the news today that Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is stepping down. There's much more to come. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Sandra Day O'Connor's decision to step down from the Supreme Court. Here's Justice O'Connor in 1992 giving the court's decision in the case Planned Parenthood v. Casey, a ruling that reaffirmed Roe v. Wade.
And we conclude that the central holding of Roe should be reaffirmed. Some of us as individuals find abortion offensive to our most basic principles of morality. But that can't control our decision. Our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code. We reaffirm the constitutionally protected liberty of the woman to decide to have an abortion before the fetus attains viability, and to obtain it without undue interference from the state.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor in 1992 describing the court's majority ruling, Planned Parenthood v. Casey. I'm joined tonight by Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at George Washington University and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. And joining us now from Boston is Randy Barnett, law professor at Boston University and author of Restoring the Lost Constitution, The Presumption of Liberty. In November 2004, he argued the medical marijuana case before the Supreme Court. Randy Barnett, welcome.
It's good to be here.
How did Justice O'Connor vote on the medical marijuana case?
Well, she not only voted on our side, that is, she voted to protect the state's options to protect or to allow medical cannabis, but she essentially, in her dissenting opinion in our case, which was a 6-3 vote, she essentially adopted the arguments we made in our brief, which was very gratifying to us.
Shows how wise she was.
Yes, she's an extremely wise justice on that day. Also, the day of the oral argument, she was very hard on the Solicitor General, Paul Clement, and actually had him backed up and sort of in a corner until Justice Kennedy ran to his rescue and gave him an argument saying, well, couldn't you also argue this? And and the Solicitor General said, oh, yes, Justice Kennedy, yes, we could. And then that just got Paul Clement righted, and he was okay after that point.
Well, in this case we quoted from Planned Parenthood v. Casey, she introduced, or seemed to introduce, a standard that she had adumbrated, as Jeffrey Rosen pointed out earlier, which was this idea of the undue burden test in abortion rights decisions. What is that test, and what difference did it make?
The test was basically that after viability, And even in some circumstances before viability, the state did have an interest in regulating these medical procedures the way they have an interest in regulating all kinds of medical procedures. However, if they were, and then in late stage viability, late stage pregnancy, they might even have a stronger interest in prohibition. But the point is that when they were merely regulating, when they were merely regulating safety of medical procedures and other sorts of regulations that we are accustomed to, those regulations should not have an undue burden on a woman's right to be able to terminate a pregnancy. And so essentially it meant that these regulations had to be scrutinized to see if they had that effect.
And Jeffrey Rosen, you point out that one of the things that she objected to in this Casey decision, this Casey case, was that the law, the Pennsylvania law, required a woman to get her husband's permission in order to get an abortion. And there was almost a kind of, I sensed at least, a feminist objection to that. Am I right about that?
There was. It's interesting because Justice O'Connor did not like to think of herself as a self-conscious feminist, and she resisted efforts by feminists to cast her as a heroine. But in the Casey case, as in some other cases involving women's rights, her background, her gender, did seem to influence her decisions, and she wrote the part of the decision that focused on women's rights. In some ways, those Casey is more interesting as a perhaps the best-known example of O'Connor's ability to really express the views of the median voter with special precision. Polls, both at the time of Casey and even at the time of Roe, had suggested that strong majorities, more than 60%, opposed restrictions on early-term abortion, but supported restrictions on late-term abortion. And Justice O'Connor, in that case, in the plurality opinion, expressed that view and really wrote it into law. And that phrase that you had her read, which may have come, in fact, from Justice Kennedy, "our view is to define the liberty of all," struck some as remarkably high-handed. It's not the view of the court, these people said, either to follow the polls or to presume to create liberty for everyone. But nevertheless, it was an example of Justice O'Connor's ability to create decisions that tended to be quite popular with a majority of Americans.
Although later, didn't she also help to strike down a Nebraska law that limited late-term abortions?
She did indeed, and that decision, which was a 5-4 decision, prompted Justice Kennedy, who joined Justice O'Connor and Casey, to object that he felt he'd been duped. He said, "I thought we'd said in Casey that it was okay to restrict late-term abortions as long as you protected the early-term ones." But Justice O'Connor, who also cared about previous precedents, especially ones that she herself had written or joined, said that because the so-called partial birth laws didn't include an exception for women's health, they had to fall down. So that's just an interesting example of the clash between a pragmatic conservative who has a strong view of precedent, as Justice O'Connor did, and Justice Kennedy, who at least in that case wanted to give a little bit more leeway to legislatures.
Randy Barnett, as I score it, there are 6 votes for abortion rights on this court: Kennedy, Souter, O'Connor, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Stevens. So that taking O'Connor out and putting in someone who'd say wanted to curb abortion rights would make it 5-4. And then you have to take another one out of there, Stevens, say, to make it, to tip it the other way. Well, I guess what I'm suggesting is, doesn't President Bush have to have 3 nominations to overrule Roe?
I think that's right. And it's not only in the abortion rights do you see a 6-3 split on social issues, but you see it in other areas as well. Lawrence v. Texas, where Justice Kennedy is also on the liberal side of the court, joined the liberal bloc on the court. In fact, I think the news from this latest term is Justice Kennedy's move to the left. Some would say it's a move to the center, but really it isn't a move in a leftward direction towards the liberal side of the court. That really does make Justice O'Connor's swing position a little less crucial than it has been perceived to be in the past. So I think your math is right to the extent you can predict these things, and of course you can't always predict them.
I'd like to bring into the conversation now from Tucson, Ronell Anderson Jones, visiting faculty fellow at James E. Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. From 2003 to 2004, she clerked for Justice O'Connor. Welcome, Ronell Anderson Jones.
Thanks so much. Happy to be with you.
Happy to have you. Now, I was watching recently an interview with Justice O'Connor, and she was speaking about how important her clerks were to her as sort of an ongoing, I don't know, alumni association, that she kept in touch with them, that she said, I'm inviting these people to be my friends.
Sure, I think that's absolutely true. That was entirely my experience, although I think it's the experience with a lot of judges and justices and their clerks. It's very much an extended legal family.
And she said that she followed up with people. She wanted to know how they were doing. And I don't know whether they gave people advice or not, but stayed in touch with the people who worked for her.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And she's an intensely personal person and just really connects on a personal level with people and is quite sincere and genuine. I had a baby in December, and she called me two or three times in the weeks after the baby arrived to wish me well and to see how I was settling into our new home. She follows up and makes sure that clerks get jobs and that they live reputable lives. And she you know that she cares about you, and the feeling is quite mutual.
Now, Jeffrey Rosen, in his New York Times article, A Majority of One, drew a picture of Justice O'Connor wanted the trains to run on time. She had meetings. She'd have meeting on Saturday to discuss what you were going to do in the next week, and she'd often make lunch for that meeting. But she wanted people to be on time and to be on their toes.
That's true. She took quite seriously the work that we did at the court, and she expected us to take it seriously, too. But I don't think any of us felt that she was too demanding or that she was too rigorous. She instilled in us a very clear sense of the importance of what we were doing, and she knew that we were dedicated to what she was doing as well. We did have those Saturday meetings, and they were some of our best and some of our most productive, and they were some of our warmest personal moments with her. You know, she would make home-style Southwestern food for us, and we would all sit around the table talking about the cases on the docket and really came to know her as a person as well as a jurist.
Now, would some of these law clerks be pushing for principles, that is to say, for broader readings of the law than she was willing to go? Did that kind of thing come up, that sort of dialogue?
We had a really healthy dialogue as law clerks. I mean, I don't think I'm at liberty, given the confidentiality agreements that which I am bound, to discuss the details. But I mean, we had a very healthy dialogue. She was interested in what we had to say, and we were interested in what she had to say. And she was interested in getting right answers. And she would listen to everyone. I mean, she had a big sign on her desk that said, "The buck stops here." And I think that was it. The buck did stop there, but it didn't stop until after a good deal of dialogue. She wanted a healthy exchange, and she wanted us to research things thoroughly, and we did our best for her. And we were all proud of the work that we did for her. And she, I know, worked hard. I saw her work very hard.
Jeffrey Rosen, you point out that she had on the pillow, on her chair, there was sort of it sounded almost like her judicial credo, maybe in error, never in doubt.
I did see that. There was a coincidence almost that I happened to see it, because it was the chair that she was sitting on. But I'd brought a book, Wallace Stegner, who's her favorite author, into the chambers and left it there behind. And when I went back to see it, I noticed that pillow. And that really convinced me that I'd been wrong to think that she was ever indecisive. She knows her mind, and so much so that she expresses it as a motto. Once she decides it, I gather that she's pretty hard to talk out of a position. And I was glad to have seen that little detail.
I think that she has confidence in her own abilities, and that she's a quite confident person, and she's an amazingly insightful jurist. She has she thinks of all levels of every case that's before her, and gives her energy and her efforts to it, and is willing to sort of have an initial feeling and then be sort of persuaded differently by others or by herself. But she spends the time and effort to get to the bottom of things, and then did get to the bottom of things. But then once she was, once the decision was made, she was willing to sort of bear the responsibility for the decision. The decision she knew was hers alone, and she made it, and she made the decisions that she thought were best.
Randy Barnett, Jeffrey Rosen draws the picture of someone who was sort of a Geiger counter, or gyroscope to fluctuations in social opinion, and that she wanted to get it right. Is that your sense of her too, that she's somebody from her political experience who does not want to be ahead of the public? I mean, he wants to get the consensus right so that law will be accepted.
I think it's my experience that apart from her federalism jurisprudence, where she really did seem to have a commitment to the principle of federalism that was not recognized by the court prior to her assuming the bench, and she voted rather consistently over the years for the protection of states as opposed to national power. With that exception, I think Justice O'Connor could be characterized as reflecting, for better or for worse, what we might call elite public opinion. That is, the public opinion that you read about in the major newspapers, whether it's the New York Times or the Washington Post. That form of public opinion would be a pretty reliable predictor of how Justice O'Connor would decide on social questions.
Jeffrey Rosen, that's your sense of it too?
Well, I've looked at the poll numbers for most of her major decisions, affirmative action, abortion, the gay rights but not gay marriage, and my sense is they were popular with narrow majorities or at least pluralities. Now, of course, this is a hazardous business. It depends how you ask the question, and we could quibble about all these cases. But I don't think she was merely a creature of Georgetown salons, as some of her conservative critics charged. There was a famous charge by Judge Lawrence Silberman in 1992 that unnamed Republican justices, and he was clearly referring to O'Connor and Kennedy, were victims of the greenhouse effect, by which he meant an effort to court the favor of the New York Times' estimable Supreme Court correspondent Linda Greenhouse. And I think that's not quite fair for Justice O'Connor. She was a moderate-minded person. Perhaps it was a coincidence that her Western libertarianism, which was not as robust as Professor Barnett would always hope, but was certainly a strong strain in her jurisprudence, coincided with the views of a majority of Americans. But I do think her decisions were, if we were to pick any justice who reflected the views of majorities pretty reliably, I think Justice O'Connor would be at the top of the list.
I suppose one way to test that proposition, which I haven't done, and it could be tested empirically, would be to go back and see where she took a major stance in a Supreme Court opinion that did not conform to what you might call elite public opinion. And, of course, elite public opinion is not a terrible thing, and oftentimes elite public opinion conforms to a majority public opinion. I don't mean to suggest that elite public opinion is always the minority view. I myself hold I'm in agreement with elite public opinion much of the time myself. But I do think that would be a greater predictor of Justice O'Connor's outside the federalism doctrine. Let me just say a few words about that, because I really admire her views on the federalism doctrine. This is a position that she took early, before there was as much popular support for that as there is today, and she held it pretty consistently over the years. And that was not a stance that is consistent with what we might call the elite public opinion, which had identified states' rights or federalism with the egregious actions of the South during Jim Crow. That was the association it had before Justice O'Connor was a very major participant in reviving it on the court.
Well, and she took positions there, did not see age discrimination as such a big national problem. She was struck down an aspect of the Violence Against Women Act. This is the part of her jurisprudence that bothers you, Jeffrey Rosen.
Well, I don't favor an aggressive role for courts. I'm in a tradition of liberal judicial restraint, which says, as many conservatives over the years have done, that judges should tend to defer to legislatures and shouldn't strike down a lot of laws. And indeed, as conservatives have been telling us for years, that political problems should be solved in legislatures rather than courts. That was not Justice O'Connor's view. As we noted earlier, given the frequency with which she voted to strike down federal and state laws, more frequently than any other justice, aside from Justice Kennedy, if she was a minimalist, it certainly wasn't the kind of minimalism that believed that social problems should stay out of court. She was, as your other guest suggested, a very confident person. She was not terribly respectful of legislatures. Her opinions would often be suffused with a kind of anti-congressional rhetoric, a sort of idea that Congress was a bunch of knaves and fools and only judges could sort out things in clean, peaceful courtrooms. This is a legitimate view. It has a respectable pedigree, and she was a vigorous and influential proponent of it. But it's not a view that's associated with people who tend to like a smaller role for courts in national life.
She spoke of how foolishly legislators can act. Brunel, did she talk about elite opinion and about the foolishness of legislators?
You know, it's interesting to me to hear commentators talk, and I'm sure that we'll hear more in the coming days about perceived influences on Justice O'Connor's life and jurisprudence. You know, I really think that. One of the strongest influences in her life is simply her life. She followed a quite non-traditional path up to this court, and, you know, rose from being a little cowgirl on a ranch in eastern Arizona to graduating third in her class at Stanford Law School and not being able to get a job except as a secretary. Mm. And really sort of, it took a good deal of tenacity and stick-to-itiveness and sort of dedication to herself and who she was and what she wanted for herself and for the country in order to achieve what she achieved. And I think that that humble background and that background that is very intensely tied with her home state of Arizona and very intensely tied with sort of a sense of family and community made her a quite unique character on the court.
Thank you so much, Rennell Anderson-Jones at the James E. Rogers School of Law at the University of Arizona. And Jeff Rosen, many thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
We're talking about Sandra Day O'Connor's decision to retire from the Supreme Court. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the news today that Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is retiring after 24 years on the High Court. This morning, President Bush spoke about the upcoming nomination process for her successor.
The nation deserves, and I will select, a Supreme Court justice that Americans can be proud of. The nation also deserves a dignified process of confirmation in the United States Senate, characterized by fair treatment, a fair hearing, and a fair vote.
President Bush this morning at the White House. Democrats were quick to respond. Senator Ted Kennedy praised Justice O'Connor, but issued this challenge to the president.
If the president abuses his power and nominates someone who threatens to roll back the rights and freedoms of the American people, then the American people will insist that we oppose that nominee, and we intend to do so.
I'm joined tonight in Boston by Randy Barnett, law professor at Boston University. In November 2004, he argued the medical marijuana case before the Supreme Court. I'd like to bring into the conversation now from Minnesota, Patrick Schultz, founding dean and professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law and former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Welcome.
Thank you, Jack.
Before the break, Randy Barnett was making the point that Justice O'Connor reflected the social consensus and or tried to in her decisions, or at least her decisions seem pretty much to follow what mainstream opinion thought about issues. And he even used the word elite opinion and posited the, you know, almost as the New York Times editorial board goes, so goes Justice O'Connor. That's just what conservatives sort of objected about in relation to her. Is that right?
I think there are two types of objections conservatives have made to her. One is just her approach to judging. She is a modest person, but an immodest judge in the sense that she does not hesitate to strike down laws she doesn't agree with. She is not deferential to the executive or the legislative branch. She has a very robust sense of her own power as a judge, and so that rankles one set of conservatives. You might call them the judicial conservatives. And then there are the political conservatives who don't really care about what your approach to judging is. They care about who wins, what's the result. And she voted on the liberal side of issues more often than those conservatives would have liked. So I think she's ticked off different groups of conservatives for different reasons.
Let me add about, this is Randy Barnett, let me add about this notion, I'm sorry we didn't get into this idea of judging earlier, because I do think it's a very important one. One of the reasons why I think that Justice O'Connor might have gotten the statistic that Jeff Rosen mentioned before as being second only to Justice Kennedy in striking down laws is because she did tend to side with the, what you might call the conservative side of the court on federalism issues, which led to a certain number of laws being struck down for that purpose. But then she would also side, as Justice Kennedy has, to a greater degree with the liberal side of the court in striking down laws because they violate various rights of various kinds, both enumerated and unenumerated right. And if you are really on both sides of that divide, you will be responsible for striking down more laws than anybody who's either on one side of that or the other side of that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. In fact, my definition of judicial activism is not the same as Jeff's. Jeff said judicial activism is anyone who strikes down a law. My definition of judicial activism, anybody who substitutes for what the Constitution says, something that they prefer better, even if it means striking down a law.
Patrick Schultz, you, as a former clerk to Antonin Scalia, were very familiar with the jurisprudence of a, if you could, a principled conservative. That is, a man who looks for broad principles in the law and tries in his decisions to be constrained by the principles he's invoked in earlier cases. Of course, he's not always successful in that. Tell us about the strains, as it seems, in the opinions between these two justices.
They're just very different in the way they go about their work. I can remember I interviewed with Justice O'Connor for successfully, although I didn't end up taking a clerkship with her, but I interviewed with the clerkship for her, and I remember talking to her about then-Judge Scalia, and this was Justice O'Connor's third or fourth year on the court, and I remember her saying to me about Justice Scalia that she's amazed how easy it is for him, that he has this vision of what the law looks like, and when cases come up, he knows where those cases fit in his vision. So Scalia starts with belief in certain principles, and when the cases come along, they fit within those principles. O'Connor starts with the facts and gets a reaction as to what is the fair or the right or the just result, and isn't all that concerned with how she gets to it. She's more concerned that the result in the particular case accord with her sense of justice. Scalia is more concerned that the principles set forward in the case integrate with the principles he believes are appropriate.
And that, I assume, would make him an inappropriate choice for Chief Justice. I'm not saying you have to commit yourself to that. But
I would be very surprised. I've never spoken to him about the topic. I would be very surprised if he would have any interest in being Chief Justice. The Chief Justice gets the same number of votes as Justice Scalia does, which is one, and carries with it a whole load of administrative headaches that, knowing Justice Scalia as I do, I doubt very much he'd be interested in taking on.
And it would be hard for him to get at the consensus part of it. That's all I meant, that he's given to very colorful and sometimes even caustic exchanges with his fellow justices.
You know, but that I think the whole consensus-building point is a little overblown. I mean, the year I clerked there, the idea that the justices travel from chambers to chambers and broker deals and that, it certainly has happened at points in our history. There's the story of how they got the unanimous result in Brown versus Board, for example, and certainly Justice Brennan was great at influencing at least a couple of his colleagues. But these are very, very independent people, and they're not very deferential to each other. And I just think a lot of this consensus-building stuff is a myth. It just doesn't make any difference who the chief is. There are nine people there who are going to go their own way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the future. Would you gentlemen like to handicap the race to succeed, for a justice to succeed, Justice O'Connor? What do you hear from your sources about who the candidates are, what sort of candidate we can expect?
Well, I don't really have sources, so just being a poor, humble law professor here at Boston University, so I don't have sources, but I watch what everybody else watches, and I hear what everybody else is hearing, and there's a lot of talk about Attorney General Gonzales being nominated, and the talk is primarily coming from the conservative quarters who are greatly opposed to his nomination. So it's going to be a very interesting choice. If he really is on the short list for a nomination, it's going to be a very interesting decision for the Bush administration to make politically, because unless they can count on the Democrats to easily confirm Attorney General Gonzales without a fight, they can't count on their conservative base to defend a nomination of Alberto Gonzales. And so, therefore, they're going to be put in a very awkward position. So I wonder if, and I'm sure they're smart enough to see that calculation, so I wonder how that's going to affect their decision.
Well, of course, nominating the Attorney General would be keeping with the historic seat, first woman, first Hispanic justice. But Patrick Schultz, how about that picture of the controversiality of Attorney General Gonzales among conservatives?
My sense is that's exactly right, but anybody the president nominates is going to be controversial, and the Democrats are going to fight tooth and nail, and they're going to do so even if secretly in their heart of hearts they're pleased with the selection, because they want to set markers for the next fight. My sense of, in a broad perspective, what's going on in the White House now is they're faced with the same kind of decision that the first George Bush was faced with, and that is, do you lead with someone who is less controversial but more risky, a la Souter, Or do you lead with someone who is most conservative but also most controversial and risk losing it, a la Edith Jones from the Fifth Circuit? And the first George Bush decided to essentially lead with his compromise candidate, and David Souter was the result, for better or for worse. I suspect that this president is not going to do this. I suspect he's going to swing for the fences on his first selection, and save the compromise candidates or the more mysterious candidates for later.
And the fences here would be who?
The fences would be somebody who is somebody, I would say, like Judge Luttig on the Fourth Circuit, who has a long track record, and the track record is by and large a track record that is a judicial conservative or a strict interpretive judging, somebody like that. A more mysterious candidate might be somebody like, say, Judge John Roberts of the D.C. Circuit, who has, by contrast, a much less extensive record, or someone like Harvey Wilkinson on the Fourth Circuit, who, although has a long and a quite conservative record, is also older and therefore, in a sense, might be a compromise because you're going to get, you know, it's unlike putting a 50-year-old on the court where you get 25 years maybe out of him. He's more in his early 60s.
And some of these judges on the appeals court, Luttig, I've read about him, Judge McKinnon out in the West, and Roberts in D.C. These are highly qualified people in terms of their education and their scholarly attainments. Randy Barnett,
I don't know any of them personally, except for Judge McConnell, who I knew when he was a law professor, and he's a renowned constitutional scholar and somebody who received wide support from liberal constitutional scholars when he was nominated for his Court of Appeals position, and who, for example, someone like Cass Sunstein, who's highly critical of conservatives, calling them radicals in robes in his forthcoming book, said that he's on record as supporting for a Supreme Court nomination. So if you want to appoint somebody who has a track record, as Judge McConnell does, and you want to at least take away one of the types of constituent groups that might be opposed to him, he'd be a good choice.
And yet he has written, I remember looking into this a little, he has likened Roe v. Wade to the Dred Scott decision.
Well, he's no fan of Roe v. Wade, that's for sure. Yeah. And I guess we can expect that most of the people that the president would recommend are going to approach judging in a way that would be skeptical of Roe v. Wade. But the real question is what else they bring to the table besides that one litmus test issue.
Do you see any...
Right, Jack, the point you're making, he has a number of just superbly qualified people. People who have been highly respected federal judges for many years, or people like John Roberts, who was considered probably the leading appellate attorney in the country. What I think he's got is the opportunity to appoint people that the Democrats will have a very hard time calling outside the mainstream. They're not going to be able to portray them as kooks or as bizarre fringe characters. These are some of the most highly thought of judges and attorneys in the country.
They're not going to have funny beards like Robert Bork had.
No, that's what I wanted to get at, the issue of the filibuster. I can't see that the Democrats would filibuster any of the people we have named, partly because it really wouldn't be fair. The president can't have, he's allowed to have a conservative to replace Justice O'Connor, right? And this is not the make or break vote. That's two justices down the line. Is that your sense of it, Patrick Schultz?
That would be my sense. I would be the biggest anecdote to the filibuster is going to be public attention. I mean, you can filibuster both sides, Republicans and Democrats. You can filibuster, delay, put off lower court appointments because nobody knows who they are or what they are. Nobody pays any attention to that. The Supreme Court justice, you can't say to the American people, we Democrats will not let a vote be taken on a Supreme Court nominee. I just don't think they can do it.
I agree with that.
Especially, as you say, when you're replacing a conservative with a conservative.
I agree with Patrick about this, although I would just say, and this isn't something Patrick said, but I would just take issue with the fact that the president is in any way required to maintain the current existing balance on the court. The current existing balance on the court, whether I like it or don't like it, was a result of political actions taken by previous presidents that accomplished this particular composition of the court. And the way courts change their balance over time is by having presidents be elected by one party, Senate's being elected, and eventually the mixture of the court alters as a result of the political process. And I don't think that there's anything illegitimate about that whatsoever.
is Judge Bork has complained in a recent interview that, you know, we have these elections, but nothing changes on the Supreme Court. Is that going to change, do you think, Patrick?
It all depends on who he appoints. I mean, you know, as Randy was saying, this is a guy who ran for office twice, who both times made it very clear what he'd do with Supreme Court nominations, whose opponents said to the American people, don't vote for George Bush or he'll appoint conservatives to the Supreme Court. And you know, they elected him, so he gets to appoint conservatives to the Supreme Court. What will happen in the end? It's been a strange thing in recent history where Democrats have appointed people they thought would be liberal, and they turned out to be liberal, and Republicans have appointed people they thought would be conservative, and half of them turn out to be liberal. And it's been like a one-way ratchet, and I don't know why that is. It could happen again. If this President Bush, I'm at least told, is fierce in his personal loyalties, and if that carries him to nominate Attorney General Gonzalez, many people fear that will be yet another example of a Republican president intending for a conservative but getting something else.
It's going to be very interesting if Attorney General Gonzalez is the nominee. I really don't know him at all, but let me say, if he is the nominee, I can't imagine the Democrats getting a better nomination out of a Republican presidency, and yet then we'll see the degree of opposition that we hear from them nevertheless. And I think that will go to whether they're politically astute, because if they were politically astute, I think they'd let that nomination go through very easily. And maybe they will.
Of course, the so-called torture memo will come back to haunt him.
That's exactly right. I mean, in other words, it's not as though the opposition couldn't make an issue out of his nomination. The question is whether they're going to make an issue out of it, or whether they're going to decide this is the best they could possibly hope for, and then and not make an issue out of it. But of course, I have no idea what they're going to do.
You know, Justice O'Connor was quoted as saying, "You like to be the first, but you don't want to be the last," meaning woman on the Supreme Court. And she wasn't. What effect has this had, the first female attorney, first female justice of the Supreme Court? What effect has that had on the law schools, on what women lawyers think? I mean, has it made a big difference in the law? I mean, we sense it's made a difference in society.
Well, I think I covered the O'Connor hearings in 1981. I was a legislative aide to a senator, and I think people forget today just what a momentous occasion that was. She is such an inspiration to so many young women lawyers, especially the young women who I teach today and Randy teaches today. They're used to a world in which females are Supreme Court justices and federal judges and so on, but it was almost unheard of in 1980. Remember, Justice O'Connor, at the time she was appointed to the Supreme Court, was a mid-level appellate judge in Arizona. It's almost that's how deep the White House had to go to find a female Republican Supreme Court nominee. She's really been she was a very, very important figure to especially young women attorneys who came of age in the 80s and early 90s. And I hope that some of that is reflected in the coverage now about her.
I think it's a sign of how far women's rights have gone in this country, that it doesn't seem as radical a move today as it did at the time. And it's just hard to remember how sexist things were, such that her appointment was a major, major accomplishment by President Ronald Reagan.
Randy Barnett, thank you very much. Randy Barnett's law professor at Boston University. And Patrick Schultz, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Patrick Schultz, former dean and professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law and former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.